You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon. My name is Glenn Hutchins, and it's my pleasure not just to welcome all of you here, but notably to welcome Janet Yellen. There's an old Fed saying that goes, only hawks go to central bank heaven. In contrast to that conventional wisdom, Janet Yellen staked out a very different territory. For her maiden speech in Chicago, she appeared at a conference of neighborhood revitalization organizations and said, quote, although we work through financial markets, our goal is to help Main Street, not Wall Street. More than 5 years after the financial crisis, she spoke mainly about unemployment and told the stories of three blue-collar Chicagoans, two black and one white, who'd lost their jobs in the recession. It became quickly clear that this was a Fed chairman well-suited for the time in which we lived. However, not everyone recognized that or her. Not long after she took office, somebody came up to her in an airport and said, you look just like Janet Yellen. Shortly thereafter, Forbes magazine recognized her as the second most powerful person in the world, most powerful woman in the world, after Angela Merkel, a towering figure who measured in at 5 feet and 3 inches tall. As the Fed's leader, she leaves with roughly 4% unemployment, 1.5% inflation. She successfully raised interest rates off the zero bound, engineered a policy framework for reworking the size of the Fed's balance sheet, and overseen substantial increases in bank capital and liquidity. It is noteworthy that she became one of the best forecasters on the Board of Governors during her tenure at the Fed. While David Wessel was at the Wall Street Journal, they examined more than 700 predictions made between 2009 and 2012 in speeches and congressional testimony by 14 policymakers at the Fed. Janet Yellen came in number one, trailed significantly by Ben Bernanke, who logged in at number five. Perhaps Ben would agree that it's time we upgraded our forecasting capabilities here at Brookings. Now, according to her financial disclosure forms, Janet has a stamp collection that she inherited from her mother and claims is worth between $15,000 and $50,000. That's what it says. We certainly hope she doesn't plan to spend much time on it in the near future, because our nation and Brookings still expects much of her. Welcome, Janet.
Okay, I'm the second best forecaster. I'm Ben Bernanke, and I'm here to interview my new colleague at Brookings. Welcome, all of you. Welcome, Janet. It's great to have you here at Hutchins and at Brookings, and I hope this is more pleasant than sitting in front of the House Financial Services Committee.
Well, I watched my colleague do that this morning. But let me say thank you, Glenn, for those lovely welcoming remarks. And I just want to say I'm really thrilled and delighted to be at Brookings. I think the Hutchins Center that I'm affiliated with is doing terrific work on monetary and fiscal policy, and Brookings more generally, I greatly respect for the quality of analysis of public policy issues, and I'm looking forward to being here and to contributing to discussions about good public policy.
Great. Okay, well, we have time for, we're going to do about 45 minutes of conversation and then leave time for questions. I thought we could go a little bit chronologically, and I would start off by just asking you to talk a bit about how you got interested in economics and how did you decide to make economics your profession?
Well, I decided in college to major in economics and then stayed in economics from there. And I guess I didn't really know a lot about economics before college. I was very interested in math and enjoyed it, and I suppose when I went to college, I would have written down that I thought math was my likely major. But when I was exposed to economics, I was really impressed that this was a discipline that relies on logical thinking, mathematical thinking, but rigorous analysis. But is very much a discipline that's concerned with human welfare. And that was a combination that greatly appealed to me. And so I must admit, after my first economics course, that was kind of love at first sight, and I stuck with it. I also found out early in my career, I studied macroeconomics. In my first courses, I was exposed to kind of, I guess, what you would call Keynesian thinking about the Great Depression, and very impressed that capitalist economies were capable of occasional breakdowns in the functioning of labor markets that could result in such prolonged misery for such a large share of the population. And I was impressed that there did absolutely seem to be a great deal that had been learned about what could be done to address such episodes. And so that was my early interest, and it's continued.
Do you remember who your professor was in the first class?
I had Herschel Grossman was one of my my first macroeconomics teachers.
And then in graduate school, you were advised by James Tobin, right?
Yes, I was.
How did he influence you?
Well, Tobin was my teacher, but I will have to say he was more than my teacher. He was actually an inspiration to me. I think what impressed me was not only his analytic skills and his knowledge of macroeconomics and the work that he did, but also his very strong commitment to social justice and to the view that economics is about people and it's about making the world a better place. And, you know, economists use more and more these days a great deal of math, and sometimes people joke or criticize economists for treating it like it's recreational math, and some of it not really, in some sense, really being about very much. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, what Tobin stood for was always doing work that was about something and that was devoted to advancing human welfare. So in that sense, he was very influential. In terms of what I wanted to do and in terms of the subjects that I was interested in. I worked very closely with him. I took courses from him. I was his teaching assistant in the core graduate macro class. Came close to writing that up as a book, but while we were doing it, the Rational Expectations Revolution intervened and I think changed our thinking quite a bit about what should be in a core course. He was my thesis advisor. When I was first a governor in the Fed and later at the Council of Economic Advisors, I looked to him for advice and stayed in touch with him while I had those posts.
He worked for Kennedy when he was younger.
He worked for Kennedy. He was at the Council of Economic Advisors and involved in the programs in the early and mid-60s that led to a long period of strong growth in the U.S. economy and low unemployment.
Now, I have to ask. I hope you don't mind me asking. You were maybe the only woman in the class, in the graduate school, or is that true?
I think I was one of two women in my class. There were not a lot of women at that time.
Was that a problem for you?
It wasn't a problem for me. I mean, I think I was always treated fairly. Tobin and Stiglitz, with whom I worked, were always very strong mentors for me, and I enjoyed the graduate program very much. Mm-hmm. But it is sometimes a problem, so I think I was lucky in that respect, and I think that is sometimes a problem for women being in such a small minority.
So you went on, we were at the Fed, but you went on to mostly a research career.
I did.
And what, you know, looking back, what was the most exciting work that you did that you're most proud of that you still think about?
So I went, I held a number of academic jobs and then ended up at Berkeley. Mm-hmm. And I also ended up marrying somebody I met in the Fed cafeteria who...
Who was that?
a guy by the name of George Akerlof, who shared my strong interest in the topic of unemployment and economic theory bearing on unemployment. And I'd say the most significant work that I did before becoming a Fed governor was jointly with George. And our work was both theoretical and empirical. And on the theoretical front, we were really concerned with what I think has long, you know, for maybe 100 years, been the core question in macroeconomics, what to me is a core question in macroeconomics, which is, can there be such a thing as involuntary unemployment? You know, this is an important strand of the real business cycle versus New Keynesian debate. And that debate of Keynes versus the classics goes back to Keynes, and it existed before Keynes. And a key question there is, why on earth, if someone says, I'm involuntarily unemployed, I'd like to get a job, goes to a firm and says, well, you have these workers here, and you know what, I have just exactly the same skills, and I'm willing to work for less than you're paying them as an employer, why shouldn't I be able to get that job and bid away that job? And if I'm not willing to make that offer, am I not, in essence, saying, I don't really want the job, and therefore I'm voluntarily unemployed? So that's always been a puzzle of why in a market system, someone who's qualified for a job and willing to work at a little bit below, at or below what others are getting, shouldn't they be able to bid for jobs? So that was a theoretical puzzle that we attacked in our work. And so an important strand of theory that we developed falls into a general class of theories I'd call efficiency wage theories. And essentially what these theories say is that firms have a set of very good reasons when you come to the door and you say, look, replace your existing workers with me. I'm willing to work for less. Those firms have a set of very good reasons for turning you away and being unwilling to cut wages and replace their existing workers with you. And there are a set of theories. Some are based on information and turnover costs. What they have all in common is the idea that if they were to take you up on your offer and cut wages for you and everyone else, that productivity or efficiency would suffer, and therefore it would not be a cost-saving move on the part of these firms. And I think a lot of our contributions to that theory fell in terms of the sort of sociological models, violations of fairness and the consequence of what happens in a firm to productivity and worker morale when an employer violates norms of fairness, sociological considerations, but there were also more neoclassical considerations. And so these theories essentially explain why it is that wages may be set at levels above those consistent with market clearing. But this isn't necessarily an explanation of business cycles. And an important question, and this existed at the time as it always has, is there anything monetary policy can do to combat unemployment? And the theory I just described to you actually doesn't automatically have any role for monetary policy, because this kind of wage setting is referred to as real wage rigidity. So to explain why monetary policy might work, it was necessary to explain why money wages or nominal wages and prices might be sticky. And we worked on a theory that we referred to as near rationality. Essentially, what we tried to show was that in a world where efficiency wage type considerations were prevalent, firms could follow rules of thumb in adjusting wages and prices that would lead to slow adjustment. And while these rules might not be exactly optimal or profit maximizing from their point of view, the cost to them of following these rules would be second order small or minuscule. But their consequences for the aggregate level of wages and prices and adjustments would be substantial, and therefore monetary policy could work. So ideas like that, Greg Mankiw was also involved at the time in writing similar work, referred to it as menu costs of changing prices, and those micro foundations became important in New Keynesian models. And we also did empirical work. We wrote several papers. We contributed to the Brookings papers in the 90s, one documenting how strongly pro-cyclical quits are and employer-to-employment moves, which is what you would expect in a world where there's involuntary unemployment. And we documented the benefits. People knew about the costs of high turnover. We tried to document the benefits of greater turnover in a strong labor market. We also did a paper looking when German unification took place. We were quite concerned that under the arrangements that were put in place, there would be very high unemployment in East Germany. And we undertook research that documented why that would be true and tried to suggest a scheme that, of course, wasn't adopted that would be helpful in minimizing unemployment.
Yeah, for the non-aficionados, I have to emphasize how the work on rigidity, nominal and real wage rigidity, played into the New Keynesian Revolution, which brought back, you mentioned earlier when you were in graduate school how the Rational Expectations Revolution had shaken things up, and in particular it had upended a lot of the traditional Keynesian approaches because, oh my gosh, they're not rational, they can't be explained by any kind of reasonable behavior. But these New Keynesian ideas that you contributed to were important for rebuilding that
Keynesian framework.
That's right.
This was sort of rethinking the micro foundations of Keynesian economics to try to answer the objections of the rational expectations school.
So you were a successful academic doing interesting research, and then suddenly in the 90s you find yourself on the Federal Reserve Board. How did that happen? I've heard it does happen, but
it's a good,
it's interesting transition.
It's a good question. I never had any policy experience, although I had a stint working as an economist in the International Finance Division of the Fed and had always been interested in holding a policy post of that sort. But one day the phone rang. I guess it was the spring of 1994. There were several open positions on the Board of Governors, and it was someone from the Treasury asking me if I would be interested. And I asked them to hold the phone for a couple minutes and decided maybe I should talk to my spouse and see how he would feel about moving to Washington and my son. And he said, well, of course we'll make it work. This is something you'd probably like to do. And I got back on the phone and basically said, if you offer me the job, I'd be delighted to take it. Waited a couple of months, and lo and behold, I was nominated, along with Alan Blinder, who was nominated at the time as vice chair. And so I went to the Fed. I thought that the research I'd done and the background I had, were reasonable basis to try to contribute to monetary policy. During the time I spent there, of course, and I'm sure you've had this experience as well, learned a lot about a lot of other responsibilities of the Fed, including supervision and regulation and some of the operational responsibilities that the Fed has. But, I was delighted to be offered the opportunity to do it and learned a lot when I actually assumed the job.
When you were there, it was peak Greenspan, right? So what was it like working with
it
Alan?
It was peak Greenspan.
And
what did you learn? So I did work with Alan. I guess I went in 94 and then left and moved to the Council of Economic Advisors at the beginning of Clinton's second term in 1997. And I didn't really know Alan before I went. I really was impressed with his intellectual strength, with his originality. No one knew the data and understood the idiosyncrasies of the data and could make better use of it to provide insights on the economy than Alan could. and I thought he was a very original thinker. And I enjoyed talking to him, and I found him very open to debate. I didn't agree with him about everything, but I did agree with him about a lot of things. I guess I had the opportunity to debate with him the question of whether or not the Fed should adopt an inflation target, and if so, what that target should be. And he let me do that in the context of an FOMC meeting, so it went into the permanent record. I was on record then as saying I thought we should adopt a numerical inflation target, and I thought it should be 2%. And I think I articulated the reasons about the zero lower bound and nominal wage rigidity that later, you know, became central to our decisions. Alan's view was that we should not adopt an inflation target at all. And, of course, he was successful in stopping that from happening until you and I worked together. And it, I think, had long been your desire to see this happen as it had been mine. And I think we, you know, you especially should feel proud that you were able to put in place what I think has been a successful framework. Alan was also very focused on the stock market at the time. And he gave his famous irrational exuberance speech, I believe it was the fall of 96. He showed it to me in advance, and he asked me my opinion. And I read this long, dry speech, and I think it was something like page 26 of this speech he was going to give in the evening. I think it was at the American Enterprise Institute. And there was this reference to irrational exuberance, and I thought, nobody is going to be awake by the time he gets to this. And this is really just deeply buried. And I told him I thought this was simply too mild and nobody would get the point. And that was an error in judgment on my part. He gave the speech and the stock market immediately swooned. But after that, of course, after the stock market immediately tumbled, it regained all the ground it had lost and continued week after week to reach new heights. And Alan decided that maybe there was a good reason for the stock market to be that high. Now, I frankly never changed my opinion about that, but he did because he became very focused on productivity growth and the notion that although it was not apparent in the statistics at that time, that we were really seeing a substantial pickup in productivity growth. And so for the last couple of years that I was at the Fed, unemployment was falling. It was falling below levels that were then thought to be the level of the longer run normal rate of unemployment. Inflation was already running above 2%, but it had come down. And many of us, including Alan, were anxious to make sure that inflation did keep coming down gradually over time. And not raising rates when the unemployment rate was falling ever lower struck almost everyone on the FOMC as a mistake. And I will have to say that I fell into the same category. I, too, thought it was a mistake. By the fall of 1996, I went to Alan and basically said, I'm willing to support you in not raising rates at this meeting, but I doubt that I'm going to be able to support this very much longer. I think the case is there to raise rates. Well, again, I turned out to be wrong. You know, there was perhaps one rate increase from then until late into the 90s. The unemployment rate continued to fall, and inflation continued to be very low. Alan was focused on productivity. He also thought workers felt very insecure because of technological change, and it was constraining wage bargaining. And those were some ideas I actually was pretty sympathetic to. And so he and I had very good discussions. I wrote something on that topic. It looked at things in a theoretical model that I think he wasn't he wasn't that familiar with, and I think he valued that.
So you and I had the same path from academia to being a governor, then going to the CEA for a period.
Yes.
That was a great job. I liked that job. Tell us about your experience with the CEA.
Well, the CEA was a fascinating job, and you're involved with every aspect of economic policy. With respect to, you know, the performance of the macro economy, it was a wonderful time. And, you know, by the end of the 90s, I think the final month of 1999, the unemployment rate had fallen to 4%, and inflation was running around 2%, so inflation hadn't picked up.
Yeah.
it was terrific, and we were certainly celebrating in the White House. We worked a lot on the budget, and I participated in an event in which we were able to announce that at long last the budget was balanced. We were very concerned, as I remain at least as concerned now or more so, about the longer run trajectory for the federal debt, and worked hard on devising a plan by which, as the budget went into surplus, we would take those surpluses and pay down the debt and create some additional fiscal space that would be, that wouldn't be all that would be needed to address long-term fiscal issues, but it would be a down payment, and we worked on that. I suppose more than any other topic, I spent a great deal of time on climate change. I was there during the run-up to Kyoto and after Kyoto, and the Council of Economic Advisors was deeply involved in working on climate change policy.
I remember the Fed was planning for what would happen when all the Treasury debt was paid back, and how were they going to run monetary policy?
Yeah, that was really that.
So you were in these two important positions in the 90s, and then you wrote a book with Alan Blinder about the 90s, as I recall.
Right.
What lessons did you take from that decade? Is it repeatable?
So perhaps we're repeating it, but I guess I took away two lessons. Or that we expanded to particular lessons in that book. One is that Clinton's first steps, first economic policies, were to put in place a plan that would lower budget deficits. And there had been great concern about out-of-control budget deficits, and I think it was reflected in high long-term interest rates. But the Clinton administration was... rightly, I think, very concerned that tightening fiscal policy, you had an economy that was just recovering, unemployment remained high, and they were worried about the negative impacts of fiscal tightening on the economy. I think our read, so let me just say at the outset, in general, the view that tight fiscal policy tends to depress employment and economic activity, I believe to be correct, and I'm not questioning that. But the Clinton policy was one that phased in very slowly over time a tightening of fiscal policy. So it wasn't a tightening in day one or year one that was dramatic. And I believe it was a very credible multi-year commitment, which served to quickly bring down dramatically long-term interest rates. So in point of fact, I think for at least for several years, this was a fiscal tightening that actually was expansionary because the decline in spending or increase in taxes didn't occur immediately and long-term rates came down very quickly. So the economy continued to recover. So the notion that a very well-designed fiscal tightening policy need not have adverse impact on economic activity was one lesson we took away. Another lesson, well, we looked at why was it possible for unemployment to decline as low as 4% and inflation stay so very low? And again, we have a similar situation with inflation isn't even yet up to the Fed's 2% target. And I think our conclusion was that that good experience reflected a set of favorable supply shocks. the most important of which was what Alan had pinpointed, which was that productivity was really increasing dramatically, unfortunately temporarily, but dramatically, and that was holding down prices. In addition to that, and unfortunately that's not one of the things that is currently operative, in addition to that, there was a strong dollar. The appreciation of the dollar was holding inflation down, and oil prices also plummeted at that time. And those things have been operative in the U.S. recently. Finally, on top of that, we pinpointed a decline in the pace of health care cost increases. This was a period in which there was a restructuring, many people moving from fee-for-service to managed care-type plans, and at least for a period, it held down the growth of health care costs significantly, and we also concluded that that was, so all of these were supply shocks, but we concluded that that was important, and I think in the present situation, some of those things are present as well.
Okay, so you went back to academia. Then in 2004, was it that you became the president of the San Francisco Fed?
Yes.
What was it like being, this is one experience you've had. You've had more experience in the Fed than almost anybody, maybe literally anybody except perhaps Greenspan. I was never a Reserve Bank president. You had some time at that job. How's that like? What is that like? How's it different from being a governor?
So a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. One way is that an important job of a Reserve Bank president is to collect information that can be helpful in bearing on monetary policy and understanding what's happening in the economy. So the Reserve Banks are structured. They're a quasi-public, quasi-private kind of entity. They were chartered to serve a public purpose, but structured like banking organizations with private sector boards of directors. And those directors, a president meets with regularly, an important role that they have is to provide information on what they're seeing in the economy. And more broadly, Reserve Bank presidents are expected to interact with all significant groups in the areas that they serve, both business leaders, also members of community groups, labor groups, to try to understand what's happening in the economy. So due to, I suppose, historical accident, the 12 regions of the Federal Reserve, the 12 districts, aren't of equal size. The San Francisco region, I guess, back in 1913, there wasn't all that much out west, but there got to be quite a bit. And so my district represented 20% of the national economy and covered 9 states. And so, you know, I traveled all over our district, meeting with people and trying to understand what was happening and to distill all that I heard into something that could be relevant input for monetary policy. We also had a lot of operational responsibilities. Of course, supervision is something that's important, and you oversee the supervisory staff. But we also had operational responsibilities for check and cash and other things. And some of these things, like check, they're businesses. And under U.S. law, they have to, when there's competition with the private sector, they have to cover their costs. When I got to the San Francisco Fed, check volumes were declining at an astonishingly rapid rate. So it was clear that check was going to be a contracting business. And you can imagine that with substantial fixed costs and huge declines in check volumes, covering costs was an extraordinarily difficult task. And so for my first couple of years there, I was involved in essentially having to shrink the operation. My first week in the job, I had to send out pink slips to employees in two of our branches who were involved in check that we were going to close, and I'd really never been involved in that, and had to go and talk to them and explain to them why it was that they were going to be losing their jobs, and try to help them adjust to what that was going to mean, which was, you know, for me, a very different kind of experience. It was no surprise to them. They could see that every day the volume of work coming into their operation was plummeting. You know, the Fed during that time, during those years, went from something like 52 up area, you know, places in which we process check down to one. So it was a substantial cut. We also were very active in community development. The Community Reinvestment Act is something that's designed to ensure that the banks serve the needs of their communities, including low and moderate income areas. And the Fed was active in doing research and providing a forum to figure out what would be helpful. And I became quite involved in the community development work that we did.
A big part of it is talking, though, to your board and to community leaders and to business leaders and trying to get intelligence for the monetary policy process.
Yes, trying to get that intelligence.
And you were pretty early in identifying problems in housing and banking. I mean, tell us about how you saw those issues from your
place
in San
Francisco. I was in San Francisco starting in 2004, mm-hmm. and then came and joined you in Washington in 2010. So I was out in an area that was the center of these problems developing while that was happening. And I have to say, I saw a lot, and I think I reported on a lot that was very worrisome. From day one, when I walked into the bank, I met with our banking supervision folks, and they told me how concerned they were about commercial real estate lending. So we had booming housing markets. We supervised many small community banks, and their commercial real estate lending, especially for land acquisition and development, was growing at a very rapid pace. Their lending was growing more rapidly than their deposits. They were beginning to rely heavily on brokered deposits. They had very high concentrations, often in small lending in small geographic areas that were the center of, you know, what became the housing boom and bust. And quite a few of them ended up failing later on. My staff was very worried about that. That focused me. I had many directors and other business contacts who were involved in housing. And of course, in San Francisco, you couldn't go to a cocktail party mm-hmm. without people telling eye-popping tales about deals that had been struck on houses, how much house prices were going up. And so I heard all of that, and my contacts were quite concerned. Our supervisory folks that I met with were alerting me to underwriting practices that were of huge concern. They were telling me about low-doc and no-doc loans, about the rising prevalence of ninja loans, no income, no jobs, no asset-type loans. We supervised Countrywide for a while and looked at their mortgage business, which was growing enormously. I met pretty regularly with Angelo Mozzillo. And the San Francisco Fed was quite concerned about what was going on. We tried to insist on tighter risk controls. And one day, Angelo came up, and we had our regular quarterly meeting, and he said to me, "Janet, I have to tell you, it's been terrific to be supervised by you. You guys are really on top of your game, and we really appreciate all of the valuable advice that you've given us. But, you know, we've realized that we don't actually need to be a bank holding company. We realized it would be okay to be a thrift holding company. And so we're changing our charter." And indeed, they did so, and decided it would be nice to be supervised by the Office of Thrift Supervision that is no more. So that kind of gave me a sense of what was happening. Beyond housing, which I was concerned about, I have to say, as we got closer to 2007, 2005 and 6, I had directors who were simply telling me about broad-based financial excess. And the way one person put it was, you know, the banks and financial institutions are just absolutely throwing money at us. Never seen anything like it. And, you know, for anything. And one day I met with a member of my advisory council who was a principal in a major private equity fund. And he told me a story that simply I found terrifying. And I'll tell you how it goes. So he says, you know, there's a well-known company I won't mention the name of. There are many big private equity companies that are competing to take this company private. So we've looked at this firm, and my partners and I just don't see any way in which we can possibly win this. He said, but the head of our firm really encouraged us to see if we could put together a bid. He said, you know, we sat down, we looked at what on earth would it take in order to win a bid to take this company private. He said, we would have to get the most incredible financing terms from a bank. Not only would the rate have to be low, but even if the economy stumbles, we might be unable to make the interest payments on our loan. And therefore, we would have to have a deal by which if we couldn't make the interest payment on our loan, we would just be able to add that unpaid interest to the principal balance and automatically borrow to get through these hard times. He said, and no bank's going to give us a deal like that. Well, lo and behold, the head of the firm said, well, why don't you just try it? So they went to a bank, and the bank just fell all over itself and was delighted to agree to these terms. And this type of arrangement became known as a PIK toggle or payment in kind toggle. You know, when I heard about this, I thought, you know, this is just really broad-based financial excess. So, you know, I was quite concerned about it. I think what I failed to appreciate was that if housing prices began to fall, I just really did not understand how vulnerable the financial system and particularly the shadow banking system, how leveraged it was, how much maturity transformation there was, how much of this risk that we thought was being dispersed through the economy was really remaining on the books of these institutions. So I wrongly thought if housing prices fell a medium amount, it would do damage to the economy and the outlook, but it would not destroy the core of the financial system. And I think that was a failure to appreciate the weaknesses.
And yet, I think, frankly, the reason I think that your forecasting rating is so good is that in 2008, when oil prices had gone to $150 and a number of your colleagues in the FOMC were still worried about inflation, you were already very much looking towards the real side and worried about the recession. So you were extrapolating from housing through the financial system to the economy. I mean, what was your thinking at that?
Well, I think that you and I were probably looking at things very much alike. I think by the summer of 2007, before we ever really encountered the problems with Lehman or Bear Stearns or any of that, it was house prices were already falling. And I think it was becoming clear that credit was growing quite tight. And while the unemployment rate was very low and we tightened monetary policy, inflation had risen a little bit above 2%, I thought downside risks to the economy and to the labor market were beginning to dominate the outlook. And certainly by 2008 and after Lehman, even though later on there was another surge in oil prices that took inflation up, we had a real economic situation that was simply becoming so dire that, to my mind, there was no question that that was the dominant matter of concern and that if unemployment rose to the levels it looked likely to rise, and I think we're lucky it rose no higher than 10%, I think you know, if you hadn't done all of the interventions that you supported, God knows what would have happened to unemployment. But I had no doubt that that was the primary, what our primary focus had to be, and that inflation surely would come down in that kind of context.
Well, after those interventions and trying to stabilize the financial system, we then had to turn to monetary policy. And with the zero lower bound being effective, we did quantitative easing, we did forward guidance, we did a variety of other new tools, or at least new for the United States. What's your retrospective? I mean, there was a conference on Friday where there was a paper which argued quantitative easing wasn't particularly effective. And what's your thinking on the whole suite of tools at this point?
So I thought it was an all hands on deck type of situation, and we should do everything that we could plausibly think of to try to help. And, you know, it's a time when I think 2009 and 10, when short-term interest rates were effectively at zero, long-term rates were still over 3%. And it seemed clear to me, and I think to you as well, that there was plenty of scope to bring long-term rates down. So the two major obvious things that we did were communications to try to shape market thinking about what the likely path of short-term interest rates would be that would then have bearing on longer-term interest rates and asset purchases. So I think, you know, my read, there are a lot of papers, people will study it for a long time. I know the paper that was presented at the U.S. Monetary Policy Forum cast doubt on the effectiveness of asset purchases. But I think my reading of the full, you know, of the literature on this, I think the overwhelming set of studies, to my mind, documents that long-term purchases of large-scale asset purchases were effective in lowering the term premium in longer-term rates and bringing it down. Exactly how much, you know, I'm not sure, and it's hard to tell. There's very limited evidence in the event studies that people typically do. They capture some of what happens, but I think some of what we did was anticipated. Maybe people didn't know the exact quantities that we would do or how long a program might last, but it was expected that the Fed would do something more. So I think it's event studies have problems in capturing what happened. I think that the forward guidance that we gave was also quite effective in lowering expectations about the path of short-term interest rates. Many people, I think, including people in the FOMC, when we lowered rates to zero, thought this would be a situation that would last for a short time, not a year or two, not terribly long. You know, it was 7 years that we held rates at zero, and people didn't expect that. And, you know, there's a big debate about can forward guidance be effective if it's so-called Delphic rather than Odyssean? Namely, it's just conveying the committee's expectations as opposed to a specific commitment. And a lot of the guidance we gave was Delphic, but nevertheless, I think it did influence market expectations that rates would stay low for long. And the general policy of when you're against the zero bound, holding rates at zero for a longer time than would otherwise be called for, I think is a generally sound approach to policy. People came to understand.
David, let me ask one more question. And I just want to ask you, we didn't get too far. We're just getting into your chairmanship, and I'm sure the questions will come up there. But let me ask you one thing just to finish this part of it,
sure.
Which is, tell us about your leadership style. I mean, how did you manage the committee? How did you think about working with up to 19 people around the FOMC table?
Well, my style, I think, was very similar to yours, which I would describe as collegial rather than dictatorial. I wanted, especially for policies like running down our balance sheet, that something that would take place over many years with changing representation, voting on the committee. I thought it's important to have a program that's understood by the public that will be get broad-based support when the voting members of the committee change. There shouldn't be a change in this aspect of policy. There were other things we did as well, operational decisions about how to manage interest rates, and the general notion that raising rates to a normal level, the new normal, lower than in the past, but that we should do that gradually. I wanted broad-based committee agreement. And to try to generate that, I allowed a lot of time for committee discussion. Many meetings we would try to develop how will we run down our balance sheet. And initially at meetings, we would have a lot of options on the table. And there would be go-arounds and people would express their views. The options, there were people who would favor options that didn't get a lot of support, and they would tend to see that. You know, I loved option number 9, but I was pretty much alone in doing that. And what I found was it was great. Over time, people who favored options for which there wasn't a lot of support tended to shift their support to options where there was greater support, and gradually we narrowed things down to one and got complete agreement. So I guess what I do is I often compare the job of managing the committee to the issue a designer would have to face, who is trying to decide what's the right color to paint a room. And you got 19 people around the table, and you want to come up with a decision we can all live with on what color to paint the room. We go around the table, Ben, what would you like? You think baby blue is just absolutely ideal. David, what do you think? Chartreuse, you think it's a lovely, lovely color? And we go around the room like that. And the question is, are we ever going to converge? And I would feel my job is to get everybody to see that off-white is not a bad alternative. And as brilliant as your choice was, maybe you can live with off-white and it's not so bad and we can converge on that and it's going to function just fine. And maybe we can agree. So I felt I was often trying to get the committee to coalesce and decide we'd come up with a good option that we could all agree on.
Very good. David.
Thank you. I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center. Thank you all for coming, those online, and also to Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen. I want to also thank Glenn Hutchins for his generous support of our program here. I want to ask one follow-up question, then I'm going to take some questions from the audience. When you were arguing with Alan Greenspan about an inflation target, part of the argument was some people thought if there was going to be a target, it should be zero. Today, there's some thinking that maybe 2% made sense then, but people worry that the unconventional policy tools that you talked about, quantitative easing and forward guidance, might not be sufficient the next time we get a recession. And so there's a lot of talk about an alternative framework, maybe a higher inflation target, maybe something called price level targeting and stuff. And now that what you say no longer matters to the markets, I want to know what you really think about those alternatives.
Well, let me first say, There is a problem, and it's a problem that I think I didn't recognize when we chose 2% as a target, how serious it would be. There had been only one country at that time, Japan, that hit the zero lower bound. That seemed like a rare circumstance, and since then, many advanced countries have faced the zero lower bound, and there's now growing agreement that somehow the new normal going forward in a world where productivity growth has been low, well, perhaps we'll be lucky and it'll rise, but it has been low. We have aging populations, and the strong demand for safe assets. It looks like interest rates, long and short, had generally been trending down among advanced countries even before the financial crisis. And I think there is now reason to believe that the new normal for the U.S. and many advanced economies will be a lower average level of short-term rates. The FOMC in their December projections projected the longer run normal level of the funds rate at 2.75, which is just 0.75% in real terms. And if that's right, and there are estimates of the equilibrium real rate that are even lower than that, zero bound episodes can be much more frequent. And means that monetary policy, at least short-term rates, have much less scope to be used to stabilize the economy. And I think the first thing is to recognize this really is a problem. And it behooves policymakers and researchers more generally to think about, are there changes we can make to the monetary policy framework that would be helpful in dealing with that? So, I mean, what I've said as chair is that the tools that we discussed that we used during the crisis, forward guidance and asset purchases, I think for this reason should stay part of the toolkit. If you agree that they were effective, even if it's hard to quantify how effective, we should keep those things in the arsenal and have them available to be used. I'm not saying that that is a full solution, and there can still be situations. So what more could you do? You said you could raise the inflation target, and I suppose the type of reasoning that led us to 2%, which was partly based on estimates of how often you'd hit the zero lower bound, we probably would come out with a higher inflation target now if we were starting from scratch. But moving to a higher inflation target is a tricky business. And number one, I'm not sure that Congress would regard it as consistent with their mandate of price stability. I think the transition from a lower to a higher inflation target would be a difficult one and could succeed in unanchoring inflation expectations that I interpret as reasonably well anchored around 2%. And I think that's been a tremendous advantage to monetary policy. And there are some costs of having inflation running generally at that level. So that to me is not, it's certainly worth considering the costs and benefits, but it's not a clear, yes, we should have a higher target. That takes you to other systems like nominal GDP targeting that has some interesting advantages, or price level targeting. And I think these things are worth considering. I think Ben's suggestion for essentially making it clear that the Fed would resort to price level targeting in situations where the zero lower bound is binding, that's a type of lower for longer approach that you would codify in advance of a zero lower bound episode, are absolutely, they have some attractive features. I think they're worth studying, debating, because this is an important issue. Is there a silver bullet there? It's something that just obviously is going to work and make a huge difference. I will admit to a little bit of skepticism about that. I think these systems would have to be very well understood by the public, and I think explaining how any of these systems would work to the public is a difficult task. What's the right time to phase it in? If you were to try to phase in price level targeting at a time when you'd had a prolonged shortfall of inflation, I think you would face the Japanese situation where if inflation has been for years below your target, and now you say not, you know, you've not been able to use your tools to achieve the target, and now you say, you know what, I want you to believe that we're going to run above the target for as long as it takes to eradicate the cumulative shortfall. I'm not sure that that's an effective way that will be credible policy. Some of these policies require a degree of commitment that's, I think, difficult to achieve given the governance arrangements that most central banks have. It's not impossible for committees to make sort of long-term commitments with some credibility. I would say our plan to shrink our balance sheet is a commitment that it got great support in the committee. We think it is something that will hold over many years, but the governance arrangements are challenging. So I think these things need to be studied. I would be myself quite open to considering different approaches, and I think it's a real problem. You know, finally, let me just say, I really think monetary policy should not be, it's not a healthy situation for monetary policy to be the only game in town. And I would like to see a situation in which fiscal policy was in a better position to make a contribution on the kinds of occasions and situations we're talking about. And that's one reason that our current fiscal situation concerns me as much as it does.
Thank you. So I'm going to take two or three questions and give them a chance to answer. Helen, there's a guy right here in the pink shirt.
Being here.
Oh, I want you to tell us who you are and keep the question short and remember the questions end in a question mark.
Mm-hmm. Hi, my name is Steve Popick. I'm an economist with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And it's not working. Okay, so my name is Steve Popick. I'm with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. My question is not related to monetary policy. It's about the research that the Fed has done. In 2015 and 2016, there were a number of papers talking about the issue of replicability.
Of what?
Of replicability in our economic studies. It's something that we've been dealing with as a professional group for a number of years now. We've had some conversations around the AEAs about the inability for economic studies to be replicated by other authors. And so I wanted to know if you had any thoughts or suggestions, either of you, for ways that we can move forward as a discipline on that.
Okay, thank you. There's a woman in the front in the red cape.
Oh, thank you. Ellen Zentner, Morgan Stanley. Thank you for your service and thank you for progressing women in economics.
Thank you so much.
I hope that continues. David stole my first question, so I'll ask you my backup question, which is productivity does appear to be rising. The unemployment rate is low. Inflation looks like it's rising gradually toward the 2% goal. Do you still believe that R star, the real equilibrium rate of interest, is about flat, or do you see it rising now?
Okay, one more in the back. Rich, can you stand up?
I'll say something about replication.
Thank you very much for doing this. Rich Miller at Bloomberg. Janet, you likened the period now a little bit to the late 1990s. You said there were some similarities. Are there any lessons you draw from the way that period ended with a recession and the popping of the tech NASDAQ bubble that could, lessons we could draw for now. Thank you.
Okay. Replicability, R star, and are we going to relive the 90s? You get to pick.
Real quickly, replicability. I'm now part of the American Economic Association leadership, and I think replicability, in other words, what that means basically are economic studies. Can it be replicated by another scholar, or can the data and the programs be shown to be clean, and that anybody else can do the same study and get the same results, or even do a related study and get related results? So I think it's really important, obviously. And the American Economic Association is trying, and Olivier Blanchard here is the president, current president of the AEA. We're working to greatly step up our game on that. The journals are greatly increasing the requirements for demonstrating replicability, providing the data, providing the software, the source code with all accepted studies. So I think there's a ways to go, but this is something that has really become a center of attention at the AEA, which has broad influence in the whole range of journals, of course, that the AEA manages.
Thank you. I'll take one of the other ones.
Okay. The R star is the equilibrium real federal funds rate is rising. So let me first say, there is uncertainty about what R star is. And I think I and some of my colleagues and we're not alone, you know, many analysts have amassed a lot of data suggesting that there is a long-run trend toward lower real rates. And I think that's been important in shaping the markets and our own understanding of what monetary policy should be. But this is a matter that's uncertain, and I think people don't always appreciate the uncertainty around that. So I don't know that I know the answer on what the long run R-star is going to be, and the estimates are quite uncertain. You mentioned that productivity is picking up, but it's still at a very low level. I mean, estimates of the economy's long-run growth potential, the FOMC last, the median was 1.8%. That assumed a pickup in productivity above the abysmal levels it had achieved previously. So I can't say I'm really impressed with the pickup in productivity as being something that would boost it. But, you know, we do have things like fiscal policy are relevant to it. You know, a more expansionary fiscal policy, if it's long-lasting, has the potential of boosting our star somewhat. There were always questions about, and initially I'd say my own thinking was that the reason our star seemed to be so very low was partly because of headwinds from the financial crisis that I thought would dissipate over time. I changed my view on that and became more convinced that it was productivity, demographics, and other things that were more secular and longer lasting than were driving it. But it is conceivable that there could be some pickup, and there was something to that earlier explanation. But I don't really have a strong view on this. I think this is a matter about which there is uncertainty, and we'll learn something over time.
So, and the other question was, what lessons do we learn from the 90s, which ended with a recession and a bursting tech stock bubble?
So, I mean, we certainly had a stock market bubble. It burst. And when it burst, it caused a recession. It did not cause a financial crisis. There were people who lost money. There were macro consequences from it. The economy recovered reasonably well from that recession. It wasn't that deep. You know, it was an event that was had a sufficient macro consequence that it caused a recession. And at the moment, I think there's general agreement that asset prices are elevated. That certainly was the conclusion incorporated in the Fed's monetary policy report. An important question now is then would be if asset prices were to fall, what would that mean about the economy and the financial system? And I guess I would agree with the general conclusion that's incorporated in the last week's monetary policy report, which is that we have a much stronger financial system. It's well capitalized, has a lot of liquidity, has relatively little exposure to declining equity prices. We do regular stress testing and look, for example, in that stress test of what the consequence would be of sharp declines in commercial real estate prices. And I think I would generally conclude that, as that report does, that overall risks to financial stability are moderate, not elevated at this point. Leverage is very much lower. The financial system is stronger. Some non-financial corporations, we've seen a notable increase in leverage, especially among riskier corporations, lower-rated corporations, but household debt has gone down relative to income since the crisis substantially. So in that sense, if there were to be an adjustment in asset prices, I think this economy is better able to absorb it than it would were the financial system less sound.
I'm going to take a few more questions, but Janet, I want to give you, if you have a question for Ben Bernanke, you're allowed to ask it. So just think about that for a minute. There's a guy in the back there standing up, and then, and Hawan, why don't you go over here to the guy that gets the window?
Hi, my name is Dimitri, Chairman of Bernanke Channel and Yellen. Thank you very much for this and for your service. My question is for both of you. During your time, the economy became ever more global and other financial markets became more important around the world. I'm just wondering what challenges and opportunities that presents in your roles. And for me, the central bank swaps that were implemented in 2008 were a great example of the cooperation that's possible. So just anything along those lines. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Over here.
Okay. Tim Weatherhead, editor at The Hill Economics. I wanted to ask about deficits and debt. I'm sure you both expressed concerns over outsized debt, but I was wondering specifically what those concerns are and sort of how those will become realized and what the time frame for that would be.
2 o'clock Friday afternoon. Anton?
Antoine van Akma, Brookings Trustee. A lot of attention has been given when it comes to the relatively slow growth, or some people think slow growth, of the economy to the supply side. I wonder about the demand side, and particularly whether the growing inequality kind of puts a ceiling on demand growth.
Thank you. Do you want to take the global question?
Sure. So, yes, the global financial system has become much more integrated. It is very challenging for central banks because our, first of all, because our regulatory systems are national, not international. There's a lot of coordination and cooperation and conversation, but there's nothing that a U.S. bank regulator can do directly to deal with a problem bank in another country. Likewise, the U.S. has a special role because the dollar is so important in financial transactions, which you mentioned the swap agreements in during the crisis, which some of the swap agreements are still in place. They were ratified yet again in the January meeting. That provides a way for the Fed to get dollars into the system where there's a shortage of dollars in different contexts via other central banks. So it does make it, and finally monitoring. You know, we have, since the crisis, we did a lot to get regular monitoring of financial stability risks throughout the system. Again, much more difficult if some of the institutions, some of the borrowers, et cetera, are outside of your borders. So it is harder, but the good news is that there is a lot of cooperation. Janet and I regularly met with our colleagues in Basel, Switzerland, with regulators and central bankers, at the G20, other contexts. There are, sort of scenario planning where we talk about what would happen if a major institution were to fail, if some other problem were to emerge, role-playing kinds of exercises. So there's a lot of effort to coordinate, and indeed there's a lot of cooperation in general, but certainly the mismatch between the global system and the national borders, which are where the laws and the regulations are set, does provide an ongoing challenge there.
And inequality, and is it a constraint on aggregate demand?
I'm not sure I would say it's a constraint on aggregate demand, but I think it is an influence that such a large share of income gains have gone to high-income consumers, probably with lower marginal propensities to consume. So, I mean, we have had very healthy, in spite of that, growth in consumer spending. It is something that's been driving the economy this year and for several years, so I'm not sure I see it as a constraint, but it certainly is something that's a significant influence, has been and probably will continue to be on consumer spending.
And do either of you want to give a quick answer to why should we worry about the debt and the federal deficit, given that interest rates, although they've risen, remain relatively low, 10-year at 2.9, and the rest of the world seems willing to lend us unbelievable amounts of money. What is it that makes you think we should worry about the debt and the deficit?
I would worry about the flexibility, the fiscal flexibility. So now with low interest rates, despite the fact that debt GDP ratio is higher, the share of our budget which is paid in current interest is actually not unusually high. But if interest rates rise or if debt continues to grow relative to GDP, which seems very likely under current scenarios, the share of our government budget, which is devoted to paying interest, is going to get higher and higher, reducing the possibility for flexibility in a future recession, a future war, or to deal with long-term trends like the aging of the population. So I'm not particularly alarmist about this. I don't think we're looking to some kind of near-term crisis because of federal debt. I just worry a bit about the medium-term to long-term loss of fiscal space, fiscal flexibility, which will come in handy when inevitably there will be some kind of challenge that we want fiscal policy to respond to.
Okay, a couple more. There's a gentleman here and a woman over here. Delon, can you stand up?
Hi, this is Kevin Murin from SGH Macro for Janet. Just wonder if you could touch again on the mystery of inflation, low inflation. There's an assumption out there that inflation is returning soon or even quickly. But how certain can we be that our hope for wage increases or wage growth this year automatically translates into corporate pricing power?
Okay, thank you. Go on.
Chairman Bernanke, you helped.
Tell us who you are.
I'm sorry? Oh, Elon from CNBC. Chairman Bernanke, you helped pioneer more transparent communications. Chair Yellen, you continued that commitment as well. But when you look at the recent volatility in the marketplace, do you guys question the progress or success you've made in communications? Are the markets still misinterpreting the Fed?
Are the markets still
misinterpreting?
Misinterpreting the Fed. Do you want to take the inflation question? Are we ever going to get inflation?
So, you know, my view has been that the shortfall of inflation from 2% is something that's likely transitory with unemployment as low as it is and having fallen below most estimates of its longer run natural rate, with neither the dollar nor oil prices holding inflation down. The median of the SEP in December expected that in 2018 inflation would move up to 1.9 and reach 2 in 2019. So although we've had a shortfall, and I think the most recent 12-month change in the core is still running at 1.5%, I do believe that it's going to move up in the coming months as some outsized declines in inflation that occurred a year ago that were associated with plummeting mobile phone prices and some other idiosyncratic declines in prices that occurred a year ago. As they drop out of the index, I expect that this spring inflation will move up, not to 2, but a little bit closer to 2. So I guess what I've said is that I see the standard framework that sees inflation as being largely determined by inflation expectations, slack, labor market slack, a variety of supply shocks, as a reasonably sound framework for thinking about inflation. And I don't think that it's exhibited massive failures in recent years. So yes, inflation has been now for many years below 2%. Such a framework would have attributed that to first a lot of slack in the labor market, then that plus plummeting oil prices and an appreciation of the dollar. So for many years, low inflation has not been mysterious in terms of its causes. 2017, the model saw no reason for inflation to be as low as it was. So that was a negative error term. In 2016, exactly the opposite was true. Inflation hit 2%. The model didn't expect it to be at 2%. Of course, there are errors. I'm not saying that we have a perfect understanding of inflation. There are a whole variety of shocks that cause actual inflation in any year to depart from the predictions of the model, but it's not as though the errors have all been one-sided in a way that would cause you to say this model just isn't working, we really need to rethink it. So my scenario, but while having a very open mind and knowing that perhaps this framework needs to be amended in some critical way, my baseline assumption is that the shocks that held down inflation last year are likely to prove transitory, and I would see inflation as moving up. I guess I interpret, you should never make too much of any month or two of data on either prices or wages, but I see incoming data as not inconsistent with inflation moving in line with the committee's assessment that it's going to go back up to 2%. Wages, I think, don't have a, you know, wages, to my mind, if you look broadly at most wage series, have been gradually edging up their rates of increase. And the relationship between wages and prices is not tight.
And does the recent volatility in the market have anything to do with the degree of transparency from the Fed? I think that was Alon's question. Is that right? And is there anything that we should we welcome or fear this recent volatility?
So the recent volatility is nothing exceptional on a historical basis, as the veterans here are quite aware. The purpose of Fed communication is not to eliminate or suppress volatility. The purpose is to eliminate unnecessary misunderstandings, unnecessary communications problems that lead to extra volatility, more than otherwise would be coming from the fundamental economy. So I think, you know, I think that communication has come a very long way. It's only been a quarter century since the Fed even began issuing a statement after its meetings, and now we have far more information provided about the outlook for the economy, about even what the Fed thinks or the FOMC members think are going to be the path of interest rates. So it's a work in progress. I would compare Janet's handling of the balance sheet with my handling of the balance sheet as example of how technological progress exists even in central banking. So I think there's still a lot to be learned there. But I do feel that transparency and communication have been very positive and is continuing to improve. And I would just note, you know, we're meeting this afternoon instead of this morning because Chairman Powell's inaugural testimony this morning, and he emphasized very strongly his commitment to expanding transparency and explaining what the Fed does, which I think is good not only from a policy point of view and a markets point of view, but also good from a democratic accountability point of view.
I want to ask you one question before we have to close. I'm looking for short answers here. So the economy is in good shape. GDP is growing, not as fast as we'd like. The unemployment rate is at 17-year low. Inflation is gradually moving up to target, if you're right. What is it that we should worry about most that might bring an end to this remarkable expansion?
I think they're you know, I would call them, broadly speaking, international political or geopolitical risks in terms of the international geopolitical situation, concerns about trade, concerns about international cooperation and the like. I think, you know, the economy itself, as you say, is growing in a pretty healthy way, but I don't know if markets are fully incorporating the risks that might exist, you know, in the global system.
So I would certainly agree that those are significant risks that could cause a future downturn. I guess as Chair Powell mentioned this morning in his testimony, what the Fed needs to do at this point is guard against a risk of overheating while recognizing that inflation continues to run below 2%. We have an economy that's operating below estimates of its normal longer-run unemployment rate. Job growth has been running at about 175,000 a month. You know, it's important to stay on a path where the economy doesn't overheat to the point that the Fed is forced into a rapid increase in interest rates that could cause a recession. And I don't expect that to happen. There's no reason why it should happen, but it is important to guard against overheating of the economy.
Thank you, Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke. Thank you all for coming.